We'll ask him.
And here we are back again. It's Sunday, and that must mean it's the
main course.
I'm Katie Kiefer, and you're
Patrick Martins.
This is Heritage Radio Network. We are broadcasting from the back of Roberta's restaurant in lovely Bushwick on Moore Street. Our sponsor today is...
Who should we make it? We could choose from a few.
Oh, let's do Hearst Ranch this time. Hearst. We haven't done Hearst in a while. And we are being engineered by...
Nat Wiener.
And our producer today is Jack Inslee. Thank you very much, gentlemen. And we have a great show lined up today. We're going to be talking to Ari...
Weinzweig?
Thank you.
I've never spelled that name correctly.
But Ari is not only the author of Guide to Better Bacon, just released.
Yeah.
A new title. But he also works for Zingerman's, which is one of the biggest mail order businesses in the United States for fine foods. So this should be a fun conversation.
Ari travels all around the world to find the very best stuff, and then he figures out a way for them to ship that stuff to Ann Arbor.
I can't wait to talk to this guy, because you know me, I love to hear about those trade regulations.
You are all into importation.
I am.
He also has, I think his goal is to have 10 businesses all in Ann Arbor.
Really?
By the, end of the decade or something. I think they have 6 or 7 now.
Wow. Besides Zingerman's?
A creamery.
What is his role there?
Well, the deli was first.
Uh-huh.
Then there was, a training thing. There's a bakery. There's a creamery. I think they're going to do some cured meats. I'm not sure, but it's stuff like that.
That my friend Daphne Zeppos, who does cheese, was negotiating with Zingerman's. I don't know what the outcome of it was, but to develop a whole fromage affineur program with them. So that could be really fun.
Absolutely.
They're clearly on the cutting edge.
They absolutely are. We just saw some, we're going to have sit in at the very end, Renato and Anya.
Oh, that's exciting.
Who just showed up here. He was
excellent.
My old boss at Slow Food International.
You had a boss, Patrick?
Yeah, he was like a colleague.
It's kind of hard to imagine.
But, so that was cool. And then who else do we have? We have Tim from La Tienda.
I'm really excited about talking to Tim, too. La Tienda is a mail order business that specializes in Spanish products. And so since Spanish foods, all things Spanish in the culinary field are becoming super, super trendy right now, it'll be fun to hear about the genesis of that business and how he got that off the ground. And again, what it's like to have to deal with all those foreign producers and getting their products into the States.
Yeah, he is the foremost importer of the really high-end stuff, like La Bellota and all of
Ooh.
That stuff, you know?
Yeah, the acorn-fed pig.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, and otherwise, Curtis had his show this week, by the way. That was really
good. Awesome,
might be our best
it?
Show already.
Oh, well, don't say that.
I mean, it might be one of, in terms of just sheer
raising the bar there
content.
Yeah, it was a good conversation. He had some fun guests on. It's called Burning Down the House, conversations on art, architecture, and design.
Awesome.
So Thursday nights at 8.
So maybe we'll take our minute break and come back with Ari.
Absolutely.
So here we are back. If it's Sunday, it's the main course. Isn't that right, Katie?
That's what I've heard, Patrick. That's right. This is the Heritage Radio Network. We are sponsored by the Hearst Ranch today. And we have Ari
Weinzweig. Did
I'm
we pronounce
sorry.
That right?
Are you there?
I'm there.
Cool.
Close
so
enough.
Tell
Close
us how
enough.
To say it. Tell us to say it.
Oh, Weinzweig, but I just ignore
Weinzweig.
It. There's not
okay.
a lot of Aries, so I can get away with it.
That's cool. And what's the name of your book is The Guide to Better Bacon.
sorry, I'm popping. Kingerman's Guide to Better Bacon is the name of the book. It's true.
Beautiful.
And it includes 42 recipes, Ari. Are they all your recipes?
Well, they're all, you know, learned from somewhere, so, but they're all tested and, you know, adapted and all of that. It's actually probably more than 42 because there's variations and additions and all that sort of stuff, but we decided not to overpromise and underdeliver, so get the lower number on the cover.
And who is your who are some of your bacon mentors? I mean, I know you travel the U.S. and Europe and the world, you know, looking for new products. Who are some of your key mentors for, you know, your love of bacon?
Well, the cool thing of my mentors for love of bacon, I guess, is just built over many, many years of tasting and learning. And, you know, the thing of the book for me is really sort of less about the momentary excitement around bacon, although that's really great, and really more for me just sort of looking at a, you know, slow, really positive, steady building of a relationship over time by, you know, learning about it and cooking with it and meeting the people who produce it. And so in the book, let's see who's in there. A lot of people that you know, Sam Edwards. I know you guys do a lot of stuff with him from Virginia. He's great. The Newskies from Wisconsin. Ronnie and Beth Drennan at Broadbent's in Kentucky. The Arkansas peppered bacon that we get through Ham I Am down in Arkansas. Alan Benton, of course, in Tennessee. And then there's all sorts of other interesting people in there, too, which I can fill you in on if you want.
I was interested by the guy who produces an unsmoked bacon that is only used as a flavoring agent and isn't something that you would necessarily include in, say, your breakfast lineup or, you know, in a spaghetti dish or something like that.
Yep.
Let's talk about that for a second.
It's in Finchville, yeah. Kentucky, Bill Robertson. And, you know, it's just, you know, part of what I love about the writing and the work that we do to, you know, to sell the food and learn about it is just, you know, you uncover these, as you're aware, you know, small traditions that really aren't known outside anywhere. And,
outside of their region, that's right.
Yeah, I told a story in the book. I mean, when I called down there, he like barely would let me have a sample of it because he was, you know, he said they get so frustrated because people call and return it because it's, you know, it's too salty or whatever. And it's like, he's like, this is just a cooking bacon and, you know, we don't smoke it and you got to promise not to cook it with your eggs. I'm like, okay.
So, Ari, what's the difference between that and, say, fatback or salt pork?
Well, they're all kind of related. I mean, it's just this is belly, not back. So, and it's got a little bit. It's got more meat on it than you get with the fat back.
Right.
You know. So, but you know, they're all related and they're all used in similar ways. But it's definitely belly, and it's a dry cure for a long time, and it's just not smoked.
And it has, but it's dry cured with sugar and salt, the way other traditional bacons are.
Yeah, and we use it a lot when we do specials, like at the Roadhouse. We do, you know, the Kentucky style green beans, which is a really long cook.
I was amazed. I read that recipe, and it's like an all day affair with the green beans.
Yeah,
well, I can't believe there's anything left of the green beans.
Well, there is.
Okay, we'll take your word for it.
Well, it's not dissimilar in Greece. You know, I'm not the world's expert, but I mean, they have a similar tradition called Ladi of cooking the vegetables a really, really long time with a lot of olive oil. And, you know, you get that same sort of osmosis penetration of the vegetables and this really sort of rich, tender flavor that is, you know, not better or worse, but kind of the antithesis or 180 degrees from the, you know, lightly cooked vegetables, which are also really good. It's just a different way of doing it.
Sure. Well, it's a great way to use up those big, big string beans that have gone past sort of their prime, I would imagine, right? When you leave them on the vine a little bit too long.
That's true.
And does, well, I guess historically, I mean, you call bacon the olive oil of North America. In fact, that's one of the chapter headings in your book. Tell us a little bit about what you mean by that.
Well, it's just, you know, I actually came to both olive oil and bacon from the outside. You know, olive oil because I grew up in Chicago and we in a Jewish family we didn't eat a lot of olive oil.
Or bacon, I would imagine.
And bacon we didn't eat any because we kept kosher. So, you know, neither is part of my upbringing. So for better and for worse, I guess, you know, I kind of have learned about both from the outside in. And, you know, olive oil, when you study it, it's great to eat, but, you know, also it's just clearly woven through all of the politics, the religion, the economics, you know, the, the cooking, everything of the Mediterranean. I mean, you find it in everything, and you know, they use it in religious ceremonies. People traded it all over, you know, et cetera. And so the more I started to study bacon, I started to realize that it had very much the same, you know, common themes. Mm-hmm. It's one of the, other than sort of Jews and Muslims and vegetarians, it weaves together almost all of the ethnic groups of North America. You know, if, like olive oil, it was really used as a major flavor component of many dishes. So, you know, people, I think, you know, in modern era America, you know, think of bacon as a couple strips to go with your eggs or on a BLT, which is fantastic. But, you know, it's also a really, really important cooking ingredient, like in the green beans that we just described. So in the same way that olive oil, you know, you don't really see it as the prominent item in many dishes in the Mediterranean. It's really a critical piece of the flavor. The same with the bacon. And, you know, as you look at the history and economics of it, too, I mean, it was taken on the wagon trains, I think, you know, going from memory, the average wagon going west, you know, in the 18th and 19th century took 100 to 150 pounds of bacon per person. Wow. Because it kept really well. Well, it kept really well like the olive oil. And again, it was used, you know, small bits of it could be used to flavor other foods. So if you were out fishing or hunting or gathering, you know, vegetables or fruit in the wild, you could use bacon to season it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, again, it shows up in much the same ways, and really was quite an interesting comparison for me.
Oh, it must have been a lot of fun doing the research on this book. That's the kind of food history I absolutely love.
I found out something about American history about droving, the drovers. Yeah. Do you know what a drover is, Katie?
Yes, I do.
Because you were a butcher, right, for a while?
Yes.
Tell us about droving and some of the interesting facts you learned about that. I never knew that function existed in America.
Yeah, well, I definitely, and it sounds like Katie, too, have a high fascination with totally obscure information that no one else generally cares
That's
about.
Exactly right.
But on this radio show, actually, probably a lot of people do. You know, like I'm really interested in ice harvesting just because it completely doesn't exist. But, you know, 150 years ago, it was like a major, you know, activity, and there was a whole, you know, craft of ice harvesting.
Yeah, absolutely.
Very, and a very important one. So droving, you know, same thing. It's like, you know, when you look back on the history of pork raising, you know, in the 18th century and even into the early 19th, generally people were just raising hogs for their own family, you know, maybe for the neighbors or the relatives or whatever, but you might have 2, 3, 4, 5 hogs at the most. You know, when you hit the middle of the 19th century or early 19th century, you start to have a little bit of an increase in the production, and they would start to sell some at the markets, you know, in order to get a little bit of money. 19th century, in the middle of the 19th century, you start to have a lot more urbanization. And then, you know, like 1851 was the first cheese factory in Rome, New York. And, you know, around the same time, too, you have a similar pattern with the pork. As people move more to the cities, you had to get the food to the cities. The difference was with the cheese, once milk was made into cheese, it was made to last. The problem with the pork is once you slaughtered, you had very little time, you know, to get it to an urban dweller.
And they didn't have refrigerated railroad trucks yet.
Exactly. And so the whole challenge was, how do you get, you know, when you raised it on the farm, it didn't matter. You just slaughtered and you ate it. When you had people living in the city, how did you get the pork from the farm to the city? And the answer is the drovers. And the drover's job, of course, no longer exists. But in the second half of the 19th century, it was pretty important, because what they would do is go from farm to farm, buy up, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4 hogs, and then get them to the city in the only way that there really was, which was to walk them there.
Right.
And so this is sort of the, you know, much more glamorous from the 20th century American Westerns of the you know, rawhide and all that of the cattle drives. The same idea. Just, I don't think anybody made any movies about drovers. So they would walk into the city. They should have, and maybe that'd be a Heritage Foods sponsored film festival piece. But
there you go.
You know, they would walk them to the city, and of course they would lose some of the hogs en route to disease or weather or whatever. So generally they would walk them in the spring and the fall because it was cooler, too cold in the winter, too hot in the summer, and then they would get to the city and they would sell them.
Right. And they would.
And then when the railroads came, that was the end of it, because they didn't need them anymore.
That's right. Well, once they figured out that refrigeration thing, the cold car, then that changed
drove
the whole
out
face
of the business. It drove them out of business.
That changed the whole face of
very
American
good
food.
Pun there, Patrick.
Yeah.
Thanks very much. I have a sound effect of applause, but I don't deserve it.
I can visualize the applause light coming on.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, why don't Jews and Muslims eat pork? What's your take on that? Like, why don't
religion,
they?
Religion. Well, Jews do actually. A lot of Jews do, but observant Jews and observant Muslims would not, because it's
but isn't that a tradition that grew up around the concept that pork harbored disease, and indeed many pigs, I suppose, back in the day would harbor disease because of the nature of their diet?
Well, that's one of the many logical and reasonable explanations, but of course no one really knows because it was, you know, thousands of years ago.
Yeah.
But you know, religion is not, I mean, you know, not in any bad way, but I mean, religion is based on, I mean, observing religion is based on what the tenets of the religion say, not on logic. So, you know, if one is observant and follows those those faiths, then one will continue not to eat those foods.
So, did your parents get upset? Did your parents get upset having kept kosher all their lives to have their their lovely son go into the bacon tasting and eating business, much less writing a book about it?
It's been I've been cooking for 30 years, and it's 27 years since we opened the deli. So they've had a very, very long, you know, run up towards this through,
to get
you
used
know,
to this.
Prosciutto and other ham, and it's been
Let's talk about Zingerman's for a few minutes.
Sure.
You guys are one of the biggest mail order gourmet food supply houses in the country, right? I mean, I came
know.
Across
I don't really
Zingerman's.
I compare to anybody else, but we sell a lot, but I have really have no clue what the stats are.
Well,
I'm focused on us doing our work better than I am on how we compare to everybody else. But
well, look, if even I have ordered from Zingerman's, it means it means that a lot of people
good.
Do. So, how do
okay,
you
cool.
you guys? I get your catalog, and
yeah.
you know, it's very cool. You have a very nice layout. I love the design. It's cute and
thanks.
It's down home.
Very
how
original.
Long has Zingerman's been in business? You started.
Well,
you said like 27
deli,
years.
Paul and I in March '82 with two employees. And just us, and you know, I don't know, 25 seats in there, 24 seats, and 4 seats at the front counter. And you know, in essence, we're still doing what we set out to do then, which is get really great tasting traditional food to people in a really accessible setting, and create a really positive workplace for the people that we were working with, and
when
you know,
did
contribute
you morph
positively
into the
back
mail order
to the community.
Part? When did you morph into
the
mail order?
Well, the mail order started really, really simply. Like, people moved away because everybody in Ann Arbor is leaving at some point in theory because it's one of those towns. Then they would call up and go, you know, I moved to X, and you're not going to believe this, but I can't get blah, 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 and could you ship it to me? And so we did. But today, you know, we our organization today, we have a what we call Zingerman's Community of Businesses. Everything we do is located in the Ann Arbor area. We're not interested in going. I mean, we send stuff and we do work outside of there through like Zing Train, which is our training business. But all the businesses are based in the Ann Arbor area. They're each, you know, we have these sort of semi-autonomous businesses with managing partners in them that own parts of that business, and we operate as one organization. So today we have the creamery. We make handmade cream cheese, which is really just done, you know, the way it was done 100 years ago. Gelato, fresh goat cheese, that sort of thing. We have a little coffee roasting business. We have a bakery, so we make all sorts of interesting, you know, traditional breads and pastries. And we have the Roadhouse, which is all traditional American foods and beers and wines and stuff. And then Zingerman's, or Zing Train, I mentioned, which we do training, and we got a course coming up with Daphne Zeppo, so you've probably talked
to her. I know Daphne, and that was going to be my next question, was whether she, I know she was negotiating with you about getting something going like that.
Well, she's going to come out in August, towards the latter part of August, and we're going to do a 2-day training course on cheese, saffinage, and
well, she's fabulous.
Buying,
she's I love her.
And, oh, yeah, she's great.
She's a wonderful
So we got
person.
All that going, and then we actually, we have a farm. We have a farm, too, that will probably spin out of the Roadhouse, hopefully, as its own business. Hmm. We're up to 9 acres and, you know, organic, sustainable heirloom growing, and that's cool, too. So we got a lot going on. And then actually the book, which you have in hand, I mean, we did all the design and self-published just in order to be able to kind of do it our way and have fun doing it.
So
how are you
going to
market
the book? Printing press?
I'm sorry?
You do have your own printing press?
Well, it's not the actual printing. We did used a local printer here, but we did all the design and the layout, and you know, everything in-house. Yeah, you did a nice job.
So how are you going to distribute the book? Where can people find it? Only on your website, or?
Well, they can find it on our website. If there's small, you know, books, independent bookstores or food shops that want to sell it, they could go on zingermanspress.com. Mm-hmm. And then we're going to sell to independents and stuff, too. So, you know, hopefully it'll be, the shops, that want to carry it.
People
and
care about
we're just
stuff.
Going, doing our own stuff. And, you know, I hope to be able to contribute something positive to a little bit of a sustainable model for books, because it doesn't seem like the most booming industry right now.
Now, I have two quick questions. One is about the whole Zingerman's empire. Like, how many people work with you? And I know you have a very firm belief on how people should, customer service. Could you just speak to the kind of trend setting?
Sure. Well, the first question is easy. It's about 500 people working in the organization, and there's about 15 managing partners when you add up everybody in each of the businesses. The second question around service. I wrote a book on that too. It's called Zingerman's Guide to Giving Great Service. And then it's out like on whatever it is, audio tape too. And then we actually have training DVDs that we sell to, other businesses that, buy those things and then use it in their corporate training, or, it doesn't have to be big. I mean, we have like co-ops that use them and stuff. But it's just been our belief from day one, whatever that was 27 years ago. I mean, that if we don't give customers a lot of good reasons to come back to us, they're not gonna. And the food quality is at the core of that. And we're driven always to improve everything. And the same with the service. I mean, if the service isn't great, people don't come back. And then really we apply that all within the organization too. So it's service to the staff and giving them reasons to come back to work, because it's just been really clear to me and Paul from day one, and really now to everybody in the organization, that, it's we need customers and we need the staff more than they need us. And our job is to make sure we're going out of our way to provide really great experiences for them. And then when we fall short, which we do all the time, to be able to recover well and, do it with grace and give them reasons to come back.
And how would you, just because it's, we're a tagging system too, and I just want to get your take on elitism. I mean, when people say, God, it's a $20 sandwich or a $16 sandwich, what's your answer to that?
Well, I mean, it's like I can give you an $8 sandwich. It just isn't going to taste as good.
Right.
I mean, the prices are based on the cost, and, we want the growers to be able to produce and make a living. I'd like to double everybody's pay that works with us. I just don't know how to do it. If we ran the same cost of goods as they did in the fast food businesses, where people think they're getting a good price, we'd be 20%, 30%, 40% charging more than we are now.
Mm-hmm.
And I wish I could do it. You could do it for less, but I just don't really know how. If everybody gets paid and you contribute to the community, and even if you knock it down 4%, so now it's a $18 sandwich, but you didn't make you're breaking even. And if you knock it down 8%, we lost money.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I think that we're open book. I don't think we are open book finance. I mean, all the staff sees the numbers; they're all involved in it. And for people in the food business, they know what's going on, which is the margins are really, really narrow, and they're narrower generally at the high end than they are at the low end, despite
Absolutely.
The public's perception. And I think from the outside, it's easily, I don't blame people. I mean, it seems like one would be making loads of money, but as it doesn't really work that way. And, 3-4% left over at the end of the year is great, and that comes mm-hmm. before your bank payments, before you buy new equipment, before you pay back shareholders or whatever. So.
Right.
I love my work and I feel really lucky, but it ain't the easiest way to get rich.
Hmm.
Let me ask you one last question, because I think we have to
really
wrap it up with you, but you've been a wonderful guest.
Yeah.
What do you think is the best way to pass this information on to consumers? Because I think the biggest problem in sort of raising the quality, the bar of food in this country is to help consumers understand why it's worth spending the extra money, given our addiction to fast food and low quality foods. So I constantly come up against that whenever we talk to any of our wonderful guests like you. So how do we educate the consumer that this is worth their while?
Well, I think we're doing it. I mean, I think the book that you got in hand talks about it, and you could buy cheaper bacon. I guess for me, I work really hard never to preach about it, and I never tell somebody that they should do it. It's totally their call.
Right.
You know, I personally barely watch TV. I got a 6-year-old TV. I don't even know what a flat screen TV does. It makes no difference to me one way or the other. I'm sure there's people who love to watch movies at home and they spend tons of money on it. And you know, I don't begrudge them. It's just something that adds to the quality of their life. You know, I think that it's, for me, it's more teaching the backstory behind the food. You know, you only got to go out, as I've done, and you know, you've probably done, and go do the hand harvesting of wild rice, you know, once, to know that whatever we pay, it's cheap.
Yeah.
It's really hard work.
Yeah.
You know, and to help people understand that the cost is tied to the amount of work, to help them understand that all of the, you know, people's in the moment negative reaction against industrial agriculture, hey, we all created it. I mean, we kept beating on people to drop the price.
To lower the price,
make it more consistent,
exactly.
And lower, make longer shelf life, and we got what we asked for. And, you know, there's just a cost to that, and if people are cool with that, then keep going. Well, you know, I'm not, and you're not, and so I'm not telling them what to do, but I'm going to work on my end and our end to just continue to, you know, support the small growers and pay more to them. And, you know, not that we never negotiate, of course we do, but trying to negotiate in a way that's win-win and sustainable, and that, you know, we pay more in the moment, but the quality of my life is better for eating better food and working with people who are living sustainable lives. And the environmental issues, I think, you know, pay positive dividends there too, and all the way around, everybody wins. Is, well, where I'm headed, and that's it.
Ari, when I look through my, my database is called a Rubrica Telefonica, which is this Italian guy gave me in my first 2 weeks of slow food, and you're actually in the first 10 contacts of my entire Rubrica,
wow,
which has been built over all these years. I think we originally met through Evan Kleinman.
Yeah.
And when you came out to the Salone del Gusto, I think you were traveling,
yep,
with her. So, you know, you've been,
yep,
an inspiration to me with Heritage, and, you know, you keep walking the walk. It's pretty impressive. So I hope you can come in next time you're in New York and see the studio yourself.
Well, it's an honor, and I will add that to my resume that I'm in the top 10 Patrick Martin's Fabrica Rubrica.
Yes.
And
that's right.
That's going to be bigger than Bon Appetit and all the beard house things. So
it's your Bon Appo, what?
The same Bon Appetit and the beard house, whatever they are, you know.
Yeah,
I don't know. But anyway, in seriousness, back to you, because it's really great what you guys are doing. And, you know, I have enormous respect for all the hard work that goes into it. And it's a pleasure to be able to be part of the network that you're building.
Thanks, and I know you'll be
you.
A part of it again. And Renato and Anya are going to be here. Renato Sardo from Slow Food International,
yeah,
in a few minutes. They're going to be the other guests on this show. So thanks,
all right. Well,
Ari.
Give them my best. And if people have questions about the book or bacon too, they can email me. It's Ari@Zingermans.com.
Ari@Zingermans.com. Awesome.
Yeah.
And the name of the book, one more time, Zingerman's Guide to Better Bacon by Ari,
yep,
Weinswag. Thank
thanks,
you so
Ari.
Much.
I am a lineman for the county, and I drive the main road, searching in the sun for another overload. I hear you singing in the wire, I can hear you through the Wichita lineman is still on the line. I know I need a small vacation, but it don't look like rain. And if it snows, that stretch down south won't ever stand the strain. And I need you more than want you, and I want you for all time. And the Wichita lineman you still own the line.
I like that song, Nat. Jack, what song was that? Do we know? The which one? I'm a lineman for the county. Wow.
It sounds
like a lone wolf guy. All along.
I recognize that song.
Well, we just saw the domestic king, maybe you could argue, of mail order. And now we're going to reach the international king in America.
Of mail order.
Yeah,
that's
if
right.
You consider La Tienda and like the myriad of exclusives they have on some of the most cherished European traditions. We have Tim on the line. Tim, are you with us?
Yeah, sure am. How you doing, Patrick?
Good. And Katie Kiefer
is
my co-host.
Hi, Tim. I'm Katie Kiefer. It's a pleasure to have you on the
Katie.
Show. Thank you so much for joining us today. This is great. I'm very excited. I loved your catalog.
Oh, my God. She,
I was
she took it. I was like, did Katie walk off with that catalog? Tell us about La Tienda and your family and just give our listeners a brief history of, you know, this amazing business of yours that's run out of Colonial Williamsburg in Virginia, correct?
It is. It's, I guess, an unlikely spot to run a Spanish food business, but it happens to be where my family lives. We lived in Spain growing up when my dad was in the military. He was a chaplain at the Rota Naval Base.
Mm-hmm.
Fell in love with Spain, especially the people and the food. And then I guess it was sort of our second home. Growing up, we would travel there during the summers, and I have two brothers, and we all spent summers over there in high school and college. I became involved with the internet industry fairly early on, and sort of as a lark, I figured that everyone had forgotten to buy the URLs for the Spanish words, and in fact, they did. So I was able to purchase LaTienda.com in 1996, I think, for $20.
Wow.
And
what does La Tienda mean?
That was my question.
LaTienda.com is shop.com in Spanish, but it means particularly a small corner shop that every little town in Spain at least had before the big chain started to move in, and I would imagine most of small-town America, sort of the little general
store. It's like the
store.
Corner deli or the bodega.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
But what would be served at La Tienda's around Spain? You would find prosciutto or
La Tienda, you'd probably go there for your groceries every day that you would not buy in the weekly or semi-weekly market, which is pretty typical.
So it'd be like cured meats, little cheeses, maybe a box of pasta. I sort of remember these in Paris, the same kind of thing, these little tiny sort of charcuterie. But they sort of had a little bit of everything. Sometimes they would sell a little bit of wine or, you know, some juice.
And no gastronomia in Italy, I think they called them for short. I guess that was the latest name.
Sure.
And so what products did you end up putting onto this website? I mean, what products do you represent here in the United States?
So it's interesting, and I love how things come full circle, but the first product that we put up there in 1996 was a picture of a Serrano ham, and we simply said, hey, we'd love to bring this ham in from Spain. Leave us your email address if you'd be interested as well. And that's really what launched our website, and it took several years for the first jamón serrano to be imported into the U.S., and while we were waiting, the folks that had signed up, and it was immediate. I mean, in 1996, if you put up a new website, people would come and visit it because it was a new website, so it was a little different than it is now where there are billions of websites. But we immediately had a following, and we kept people apprised of our pursuit to bring in jamón serrano. And while they were waiting, they asked for different things like artichoke hearts or piquillo peppers. Or we now have close to 900 different items from Spain.
Hmm.
How do you source your products? You go over there on buying trips. You find producers that you like, or
we do. Although
people that
I
you
have
knew from
admit,
growing up.
In the beginning, it was mostly our customers saying, hey, check out this producer or that producer. Like many emerging, I guess, countries that are starting to import in the U.S., the first wave of products that you get in is not necessarily the best.
Mm-hmm.
What we tried to do was just continue to, if we had an item like a piquillo pepper, we would travel over there and then really start to research. And our emphasis is finding small family businesses who are doing things in a traditional method. Sometimes we'll start with an industrial product. It'll then lead us to learn about, well, where did this product really come from? And then we'll find a great family business that maybe has been doing that product for five or six generations. And so we've tried to do that with each item.
Sure.
And we do go over there a lot. I'm actually moving my family over there in after Christmas for 6 months.
Wow. You have kids in school? How are you going to manage that?
Yeah, we found a great school. I went there. I went to school in the 70s in Spain as a kid, and it's a great way to get a different perspective on life and learn Spanish.
You betcha. Absolutely.
While you're little.
Yeah. I mean, my family moved us around quite a bit, too, so I had the same experience. I lived in France and when I was a teenager, and it was just the best thing that ever happened to me. But anyway, to go back to your business, let's talk a little bit about the importation issues. Like, do you have, you know, how did you get this? Because there weren't a lot of products really being imported from Spain. And then there was all the controversy over raw milk cheeses and bringing in meats and cured meats and stuff. There's a lot of regulations about that. Did you guys just kind of learn that on the fly, or... Or had you had some background that helped you?
No.
It's challenging, right?
It is, but I've always thought that the things that are more difficult to do, you'd have less competition, and they're more interesting. So more challenging, I guess, intellectually. It's been interesting learning about the bureaucracy. The FDA, USDA, and FSIS are different agencies that protect our food supply here. They actually, you know, they're not doing it. A lot of Spaniards think that our rules are really erected to act as a trade barrier.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think that's true. And in some cases, it's frustrating. In the case of the Jamón Serrano and the Jamón Ibérico, they rejected the first load that came in because of all the wonderful mold that was on the ham. And we actually traveled with a Smithfield ham from Virginia up to Washington, D.C., and said, hey, look, this is the same product that we're selling, that we're seeing domestically sold. What's the big deal? And they pulled them both out and said, you're right. And that was...
Who did you go to?
I'm amazed, because I would have thought they would say, well, those are foreign molds, and these are domestic molds, and we like our domestic ones.
Foreign.
Yeah, foreign.
We went to the USDA offices. Yeah, I don't. You know, it's a challenge, and I feel sometimes that perhaps the FDA is using us to train all of their people, because we'll bring in a container that may have 30 different vendors on it.
Right.
Well, not the vendors literally, but their products. And we bring them into Norfolk, Virginia. They do a lot of coal and chemicals out of there. So when groceries come in from overseas, the FDA, it seems like they really enjoy going through every single one. But, you know, if your label's straight, and you're registering everything according to the rules, they're fine. And things, we really don't have much of an issue. In the beginning, sure we did. You know, learning about labeling law was pretty hard.
What are the top three or four products on your website? And, you know, how hard was it to import those? I mean, one is the Belota pigs, right? I mean, the Belota fed pigs?
Yeah, that's definitely... I'd say, though, in terms of sales or unit volume, that's not our top seller due to the price. It's certainly been the most interesting thing to be involved with. So I've been working, it's been 15 years or more that I've been working to get that wonderful product in. We sell a lot of the Jamón Serrano. There's a lot of interest in the charcuterie, the embutidos, they call them in Spain, so the chorizos and the salchichones. Unfortunately, most of those are not able to be imported from Europe, but we're working with Sam Edwards and some other folks to sort of replicate some of those recipes using heritage breeds in the U.S. and bringing all the spices and the technique over, which is pretty exciting. And
yeah,
I think
we tried it. We tried Sam's Soriano ham. Mm-hmm. It was awesome.
Yeah,
it was really, really fine. Very good.
I wish you had seen Sam's eyes and his father's eyes when they walked into our store probably 8 years ago. Hmm. And they said, we want to meet the guys who are selling hams for $300 a piece.
Yeah, how do we get a piece of that action?
Well, with
right?
our price increase, he might have to. No.
Now, well, I have one more question. Do you find that the Spaniards are exporting a lot of Mangaliza pig now?
Because we're bringing that in now on an exclusive basis. Uh-huh. Just for a period of time. It's a little confusing, perhaps. There's so much excitement about Iberico and the Bellota that the Mangaliza is sort of a similar story as far as the heritage. And if you look at those hogs, other than the poodle fur on the Mangaliza.
Yeah, and they're little and cute.
They are. But we've offered that for sale for it's only been 2 or 3 weeks.
Hmm. Oh, wow. So I'm right on the cutting edge with that question.
You are. They're almost too cute to eat.
I know. The photographs of them made me feel like I'm never going to eat this pig. But then I tried some, and it was actually so delicious. I thought, yeah, I can get over that. I can get over those long lashes and woolly fur. It was very cute.
Well, Tim, this has really been great. Thank you so much for being on. And I hope, like Sam, you know, you're one of those recurring guests, especially if there's a current event or an issue
or
a spin or a new product that you need to, you know, tell us about. So hopefully you can be on many more times. I know you're on vacation today. So thank you so much for giving us a few minutes.
Sure thing. Well, thanks for having me on, and I love what you guys are doing. And if there's something that comes up that's pertinent, I'll surely shoot you an email.
Yeah, awesome. Please do. Absolutely. Thanks, Tim.
Thanks, Tim. Bye now.
Thank you. playing on the radio.
So we have a couple of super special guests. If it's Sunday, it's the main course.
It's the main course. I'm Katie Kiefer. Oh, let's
Sorry,
do that
you
again.
You go first. Let's go alphabetical. You go first.
I'm Katie Kiefer.
I'm Patrick Martins.
This is the main course on Heritage Radio Network, sponsored today by the Hearst Ranch. And our engineer is
Nat Wiener.
Nat Wiener. And our producer today is Jack Inslee. Thank you, gentlemen.
And we have such awesome guests all the way from Northern California. We have Renato Sardo and Anya Fernald.
Yeah, we are.
There you are.
Are you guys?
And Renato Sardo, the reason we're all excited about having you guys in the studio today is Renato Sardo is the Slow Food U.S.
The executive director of Slow Food for 7 years, the international director. I created with Patrick
All the 50 countries that Slow Food was in. He was, you know, how many languages do you speak?
Four.
So it was good and very successful job.
Clearly a very successful job. When was Slow Food established? I was talking to people today who consider themselves food aficionados and had never heard of Slow Food. I was stunned,
we
honestly.
Have a sound effect for that.
I think you should. There you go. So Slow Food is really a fairly impressive. New, I mean, when all is said and done, is really not a long, an organization that's been alive for all that long.
Well,
the international office was created basically in 95, 96. So
it's like 13
10,
years.
12 years. And we created Slow Food USA in 2000.
Yeah.
So it's like not even 10 years.
So that really took off. I saw that I'm a member. So they, just so you know, I'm on the right side. And they are redoing their magazine, I understand. And they're beefing up their website, so they're trying to make more of a
more of a
presence, I think, than they have been.
I hope so. I mean,
aren't as affiliated like me. I mean, we're still supporters and members.
Yeah,
but
well,
other things.
I do a little bit for Slow Food in the East Bay. So we launched them at CSA. We do some educational activities. We do stuff as a volunteer, but I'm not involved anymore, like in the national programs.
Are your two brothers involved still?
Well, I have a brother who does the film festival in Bologna, which is actually it's the Slow Food on Film, which is the festival is going pretty well. Like it's the third or fourth edition, and it's growing, and it's very well attended by all over the world. Younger brother. And then the other brother, my twin, is still working for Slow Food. He's the only one, actually, who's working basically to... he represents Slow Food in some consulting projects, mostly for a big new retailer in Italy that is called Italy. It's a very cheesy name. It's actually a pretty stunning store.
Yeah. And they're opening in New York.
They're opening soon
in
New York.
I saw a notice about
pretty
that.
Pretty impressive.
They open in Tokyo. It's like basically an Italian way to Whole Foods. With a little bit less care than Whole Food in the produce department and way more care than Whole Food in the charcuterie and cheese sections.
And are they going to embrace American traditions too, or are they more about being important?
I have no idea. I mean, I think the original plan was really to represent strictly Piemonte region, which is where this company was born and where Slow Food was born, actually, which is the northwest of Italy, a famous region for wine, cheeses, and... And so their idea was to open a smaller store than what they have in Italy, in Turin and now in Milan, and to focus on the wine and cheese of Piemonte. But I don't know what the plans are right now. I haven't any updates.
And our other guest here is Anya Fernald, who organized, I think, the greatest food event ever, maybe in American history. It was in San Francisco. They closed the whole city off pretty much, and they had, like, how many people? Like
85,000.
85,000 people in the public market. Heritage Foods ran a couple of the slow on the go stands, and it was like 20 people deep, 7 hours a day. I mean, really impressive. So, Anya, why are you in town? Were you a judge on Iron Chefs or anything?
Interesting question. Yes, I was. I just finished filming the next Iron Chef, and I've been doing some judging on Iron Chef America on the Food Network.
Wow. And who were are you allowed to say who the two chefs were?
I judged, the most recent one was against Iron Chef Michael Simon. And then I don't know who I'm judging next week, but it's always a delicious and interesting challenge.
Are you allowed to tell us what the magic ingredient was?
I think you're referring to the secret ingredient.
Oh, secret
Patrick.
Ingredient.
Get your lingo right.
Sorry.
I'm actually, I don't know if
no,
I am.
No, I don't think you are.
I don't think I am.
I don't think you are.
Sorry about that.
Yeah, I think you have to keep it all pretty secret on you, or the food police are going to be coming out.
They're very dramatic, fun battles. And, you know, I'm kind of a big food nerd, so I'm not sure that I make the greatest TV. I'm kind of always asking questions and stuff of the chefs. But it's fun. I'm tasting some interesting food. And those guys really, really work. I mean, they really do it all in an hour. So it's pretty incredible to see it in Kitchen Stadium and all the, you know, knives are flying and the pots are dropping. It's actually, it's an hour and you watch it. And in live, I just can't believe that it seems like it's 15 minutes because it's so enthralling. And, and they're just, they barely talk to each other. They actually train as groups. I mean, it's pretty intense to watch.
Hmm. And you lived in Italy, didn't you? More or less at the same time I did in the late 90s. Were you living in Sicily? Is that right?
I was. I moved to Italy in the very end of 99. And I worked in Ragusa in southeastern Sicily, doing rural development projects with artisan cheesemakers, making what is, I think, the world's saltiest cheese, Ragusano.
Oh my God.
Which,
it's an enormous brick of salt.
But its yummy. Big claim to fame is that you could actually age it at like 110 degrees and it actually doesn't suffer any microbial issues, which is pretty amazing if you're cheese. But it's, in terms of the flavor, it's a little bit, it's rough for American palates. But I actually helped develop a consortium or a group of farmers, sort of like similar to a cooperative here in the States, that represented these small traditional farmers and helped them brand their products, helped them develop sort of more rigorous production standards internally that guaranteed a certain level of quality for the consumer. What's exciting for me is that now my work in America, I'm sort of digging up a lot of those old skills and lessons learned, because we're sort of at a similar time now in the States of looking to help groups of smaller artisan producers get to broader markets, codify their products, develop regional identities. So it's exciting because I spent, you know, altogether about 5 years in Italy working first in Sicily and then later for Slow Food developing their international presidia, which are their locally sort of like, I guess, brands for local artisan products all around the world. And those skills are really coming into play now with American farmers, which are finally getting to a point where there's lots of on-farm value-added production. There's lots of companies that are, you know, I think modeled also on heritage foods in terms of getting the word out there and helping small artisan producers reach a broader market.
And what are some of the projects you're working on currently? I mean, is there any group? I mean, you had already also done a bunch of stuff in California. I mean, we're going to also have you on the next show as well, the Q Report. You're going to bridge over. But you also did a lot of work with school lunches, correct, in California?
I worked when I first moved back from Italy. I had been working for Slow Food, which is, frankly, you know, it's a lot of rhetoric and it's a lot of, you know, sort of flying at 80,000 feet and making big, broad statements, which are really important at a philosophical level. But I wanted something where I got to sort of go down to ground level and really learn what was happening on farms, especially since most of my career had been outside of the States. So I really sought a position that was very grassroots, very hands-on, and gave me a chance to work with farmers. And so I worked for the Community Alliance with Family Farmers, which is an association statewide in California of small family farmers. A lot of them are organic, but a lot of them are just multi-generational family farms with commitment to the environment, to community, et cetera. And I directed their food programs, and I actually got to build a really interesting company called the Growers Collaborative, growerscollaborative.org, which is a distribution company for produce and sells produce from small family farms, aggregates it, sells it to big institutions. And so our clients that we built were Kaiser Permanente, UC Berkeley, Stanford, Oakland Public Schools, a whole range of schools and public institutions. So it was kind of, you know, putting the biggest consumer together with the smallest farmer to build that local connection, which is essentially the hardest thing to do, I think, in the food system challenges that we have out there. So
how did you get distribution? That's always, to me, like, that's the big question, is how do you get the food from the farms to a central place and then to whatever institutional
consolidation
outlet.
Point.
I mean, we just bought trucks and rented warehouses.
So you bought trucks. Mm-hmm. So you didn't get involved with any of the big broadline distributors like Sysco or U.S. Foods,
no.
who are now starting to do what
now
you're
they
talking
are.
About.
And this is, you know, 5 years ago, 4 years ago. And I think so much is happening so quickly. And it's great to see, you know, how many companies are coming to the table ready to kind of talk about these things.
Yeah.
But at the time, we did approach a lot of distributors about having our products go through them. And they really, that type of work didn't necessarily, it wasn't doable because of their rules and restrictions. And so we just had to create an alternative system.
But is it great or is greenwashing? That's a big question.
Ah, interesting.
That I leave for the main course. Right there.
Interesting. We need a sound effect for that. But very, very interesting. And what are you guys, where do you guys live now? You guys, oh my God, if ever you're in Northern California, even if they don't invite you, you have to drive by their house. It's in downtown Oakland. It's a total urban redevelopment.
Really?
Experiment. And actually, you lived in Bushwick, mm-hmm. like over a decade ago. So you were kind of already breaking new neighborhood ground in the city.
Yeah, I lived in right here, in the McKibben Street Lofts.
That's like
we were
actually
the first
away.
People to live there. Yeah, in 1998. It was pretty rough going at the time.
Oh, yeah.
They were like taking the sewing machines out of those lofts when we moved in.
My God.
And I remember a lot of like splinters of refinishing floors. And
what drew
stuff.
You to that, to Bushwick, Brooklyn in the late 90s?
It was much more affordable than any of the other available options.
What were you doing in New York then?
I was actually waiting. I did a fellowship after college and I graduated early. So I had about 6 months to kill. And I worked as, I actually spent 2 6-month periods in that place. And it was, I did an editorial assistant at Sever. I worked in just a bunch of odd jobs and things, but I was heading, getting ready to head off to Sicily and also all around Europe to learn how to make cheese. Oh. And so I worked as a cheesemaker and then came back to New York and then went to Sicily for my first job there.
Do you still make cheese? I know you cure stuff and you're like a food experimenter.
I don't make cheese. I got a big piece of my homemade bacon in my bag.
Oh, well, let's eat it. Is that for us? Well, I'm going to order you between shows. I'm going to go order you guys a pizza from Roberta's. They make great pizzas. Do you guys like pizzas?
Yeah. We had three yesterday, but
yeah.
Okay, I'll bring one just to try it. So, you know, you have it. And then beer or wine?
Let's go with beer.
Beer, definitely. Beer.
Awesome. Yeah. Well, this has been a
very cool show.
A sad day for HRN, you know, but also an inspiring one.
Absolutely.
No.
This has been the main course.
It's been awesome. If it's Sunday, it's the main course.
That's right.
Katie, you're the most awesome co-host ever created.
Thanks, Patrick. I don't know why you say that, but I'll accept the compliment whenever they're dished out.
Okay.
Thank
we'll
you,
be
Renato
right
and
back
Anya, and we'll be back.
Thanks a lot.